The Westwood One Podcast Network.
Never quit. All right, everybody, welcome back to the TNQ Podcast. I'm your host, Marcus Luttrell. Every week, it's my job to fire you up, to ignite the legend inside of you, and to push you to your greatness. Join me every week as I take you into my briefing room with some of the most hard-charging people on the planet. They're going to show you how to embrace the suck of life, teach you the values of working your ass off, and charge through whatever life throws at you. This is the Team Never Quit Podcast. So buckle up, Buttercup.
Hey there, Team Never Quit Nation. Welcome back to another episode of the podcast. I hope you guys had a wonderful Christmas holiday. I am joined today by Marcus and his wife, Melanie, and we have got an awesome guest, Dan Crenshaw, U.S. Congressman, retired Navy SEAL. We're excited to have him back on the show. Can't wait to get to his talk. But speaking of Christmas, we've got a Patreon question of the day from Rebecca. Marcus, she asks you, what was your favorite Christmas present to ever receive in your whole life? Favorite Christmas present. My brother got me a boot knife when I was like 8 or 9, and my mom took it right away, like the same day, and I was so mad.
My Red Ryder BB gun.
I mean, come on, yeah. That's a classic.
Right? And I remember when the Nintendo came out. We got that, the video game.
Super Nintendo?
No.
Or the one
that? Yeah, Nintendo.
Okay. Wasn't Super yet.
Three-wheeler.
Three-wheeler.
Well, the big one.
I remember bikes were something I was always excited to get.
Oh, yeah,
a new
bicycle, man.
It was like the best. Especially with some pegs.
Man.
I don't know why your parents thought pegs were like dangerous.
Because you're riding your buddies.
Because your buddies are always in the back, some on the front. I love some pegs. What else? I'm trying to think of other amazing ones. Okay, let's flip the question around. What is the best Christmas present you've ever given?
Oh.
That one's a hard one, too.
Yeah, because you don't know how each gift affects somebody.
Exactly,
so we,
yeah.
We rebuild homes for people.
I feel like those are definitely the most impactful gifts.
I'll tell you one of the most memorable gifts I ever got for Christmas when I was overseas. And the Soldier's Angels boxes showed up. And I didn't have my name on it or anything like that. And I purposely told the family, like, you don't send me any stuff. Because when you deploy, it's not the holidays completely change your perspective, right? It's the one time that where everyone tries to be good and do good things. And in all actuality, your New Year's resolution would be to keep the Christmas spirit till Christmas, right? And when the Soldier's Angels box, I just grabbed one and walked to my room and opened it up and had a pair of socks in it. And I needed some of those and had some DVDs, whatnot. But as far as the best gift I've ever given...
I think I just remembered my favorite gift I've ever received. So we grew up we grew up pretty poor, like really poor, actually. And I remember I was like fourth grade. I got pulled aside by my teacher, and she's like, hey, you need to go down to the counselor's office. And I was like, okay, cool. Not really sure what's up. And I got there, and they had a gift wrap for me, and it was from the Toys for Tots organization. And, I guess they know which kids don't have a lot of money. And so they had gotten me a set of walkie-talkies. And that was the most memorable gift I'd ever received, because it was like we didn't have a lot, you know. Mom couldn't really get too much, and she did what she could. But to have a gift that felt like so high tech at that age was really cool. And I think it was like 2 mile radius too. So I was like, man, I'm about to get into some trouble with these.
My mom, yeah. So a couple of Christmases, my mom rewrapped old presents, some board games. She wrapped the Monopoly game one time. We opened it up, and then we all played Monopoly that day. It was pretty cool. And I got my first horse on Christmas.
Oh, that's cool. That's a good gift.
And thinking through that, but it was cool. It taught me responsibility, because I had to go down there and fool with him every day and put him halter and lead line and feed him, clean the stalls, and do all that.
That's cool.
Maintenance. And then Rigby and I got paired up around Christmas time.
Really?
Yeah, close to it.
It's a gift that keeps giving there. Love that pup.
Yeah. And then I got married end of November. That was a great Christmas present.
That was a present. Christmas present.
Mm-hmm. Well.
Rebecca, thanks for asking your question. If you guys ever want to ask a question on an episode, Join us on Patreon, patreon.com/teamneverquit. Get rare access to the guests and behind-the-scenes content. Marcus will actually do some Q&As there, send out some really cool, unique gear, a challenge coin that can only be gotten if you're a part of our Patreon community. So check that out, patreon.com/teamneverquit. Let's get to Mr. Congressman Dan Crenshaw.
When you were running, you ran an awesome campaign.
Literally. Literally ran through the district.
You literally ran and you figuratively ran. Which was cool. So what's your freshman year been like?
Well, it's been unique in so many ways, right? Because the whole Saturday Night Live thing that, you know, last time we did this podcast.
Good job on that by the way.
Thank you. I'm very funny, as you know. So, you know, that hadn't happened. Like when, last time I was on a podcast, I was just trying to get people to know who I am. And just like anybody running for office, you're just trying to get people to know you and have some kind of a positive view of you. That's basically what running for office is. And so, then Saturday Night Live happened like basically right during the election. So, you know, I went on the show like a week after I got elected. And then, everything sort of spiraled from there. And then I kind of show up to Congress and I'm a little bit more well-known than most freshmen, except for AOC, obviously. And then it's our freshman class as a whole, I think, has been very unique in that respect, just because of the profiles that showed up there. But, you know, and then the next step, once you have that kind of notoriety, is to not screw it up. And so I've tried very hard not to do that by not writing off the coattails of some SNL performance, because that was cool and all, but it was, you know, it has nothing to do with my actual job.
Oh, bro. Hey, like I said, man, I was standing across the street from the SNL building the night that all that was going down. And I was like, man, it sure would be cool if you could go on that show and do that. And when you did it, man, it was awesome. And don't worry about, I was thinking about now you had to worry about screwing up. Man, you never forget, you're a Navy SEAL, like it's been shot in the face. So when you walked, I mean, that's, you get a little latitude for that. You know what I'm saying? Everybody well, else you. Just I came out of whatever. Not only did you go over there and put foot to ass for God and country, man, then you know, and lost an eye and butt. I mean, look at all the stuff we've been through. But going on SNL, I had to be, it's kind of like walking back in the platoon space as the OIC, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'll talk about that for a little bit, because there's some kind of funny behind the scenes stories that not a lot of people know about, and it's and I get asked about this stuff all the time. So this whole thing goes down on Sunday morning, right? Well, because that's when I find out about it. It's Sunday morning. My election is like 2 days away, so I don't really appreciate the gravitude of it all right away. The gravity of it all right away. I don't think gravitude's a word, but whatever, we can erase
it
that
is now.
The podcast, right?
No.
No, it's saying. So I didn't appreciate.
Oh, we're
going to
put that on a t-shirt with your picture on it.
Gravitude.
earn your gravitude.
Appreciate
right?
Your gravitude.
That's all. I love it.
That's awesome.
I love it. So I didn't appreciate the gravity of it all, but the, because I was trying, I had events that day. I got to go to church, and then I got to go shake hands. I got to meet volunteers. I got to go to this, like, this event we had out in Huffman, you know, the good people of Huffman, this place called the Tin Cup. It's just a solid bar out there that we do events at. And like, that's the kind of stuff that you're doing before an election. And so like because I'd never really been in media, at least not in a big way before that, like, I just didn't understand the gravity of it all. You know, I didn't understand why I had to make a statement and deal with this. It seemed annoying at the time. And so we struggled through like what to say and kind of, you know, how I felt, which was kind of ambiguous at best. And then, you know, a couple of days passed, the sort of like outrage sort, you know, going strong throughout the country. And I guess understandably so, that's a whole other subject about kind of how we react as a country to these things. But You know, eventually, Lorne Michaels reaches out and he's like, "Hey, why don't you come on the show on Saturday? We can make a show out of this." And I said, "Well, I mean, it's Veterans Day weekend, so I already have a bunch of plans that I've scheduled. I can't really do it this weekend, but I'm open to the idea. Maybe we do it another weekend." And he's like, "No, it has to be this weekend because it's Veterans Day, and because, you know, we kind of messed up and insulted a wounded veteran. So we'd really like to make amends on the Veterans Day weekend." And I said, "Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. I mean, I understood what he was getting at there." And we agreed to it, flew in to New York Friday. You start out by like going through the scripts and doing all these dry runs and seeing if the jokes land or not. A lot of them didn't. We had some of our ideas. So it's a neat creative process that you do right there. We had a dressing room next to Robert De Niro's dressing room. Of all people, that was really
gosh,
interesting.
That's awesome.
And then, he had on Rachel Maddow the whole time. I could hear Rachel Maddow coming out from his dressing room, which I thought was a little strange. but it might explain why he gets so angry at Donald Trump. I could be listening to Maddow the entire time.
Right.
But yeah. So we come back Saturday. We're refining the script a little bit. Saturday night, you do like a live audience rehearsal. So they go through the entire show twice on Saturday night. The first time, live TV, but it's through a live audience. What they're doing with that is they're testing the jokes.
Yeah.
And they're seeing what lands and what doesn't. And then we all rush back to Lorne Michaels' office. This is all in a very small, compact place, by the way. There's like arts and crafts running around, costumes running around. Like Lil Wayne and his posse is like running around, like because he was the one performing that night, and it was just crazy. And so, I met Pete Davidson on that Friday night, and you know he was really just embarrassed. Like he's a nice kid.
Yeah. Yeah, they're all good folks, right? I mean, you had a good time doing that.
Yeah, I didn't meet anybody who I thought was like secretly had some ill will or ill intention. I mean, the way I describe the kind of mic culture war that occurred with SNL is like, were they going after Republicans in a bad faith way? Yes, they were. It's kind of just what they do. I mean, they go after Democrats too, but they mostly don't like Republicans. And that's just true. But did they want to go after a wounded veteran? Like, no, I don't think they meant that. I don't think Pete meant that. You know, I think that was just a mistake to be a little bit more open to accepting the fact that the people might make some mistakes and misspeak, and that like you don't have to assume the worst intention possible, which happens all too often. That's the message of the story behind SNL. And so we go through that dry run. We, you know, the jokes get tested out, and then we run back, we change a few, you know, these guys like redo the cue cards so that, because everything is read from cue cards, and these are written out by hand, and they're like manually shuffled through.
I mean, it's a straight up theatrical performance that they're just showing live on television.
Yeah, it is totally live. Every like the scenes are and the sets are changed out in real time. I mean, it's totally live.
That's cool, man.
It's really interesting to watch that machine take place, because like, and you could literally, you could just run it. If you were behind stage, Marcus, you could just run behind the camera and be like, "Woo," and then run away, and like that would be on TV. Like, there's no.
Noted.
There's no delay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Noted.
Yeah. If you ever get invited, just run up there. It's crazy. That's why I'm a mistake, you know, and they rarely make big mistakes, but when they do, like, it's that mistake is on TV. It's not going anywhere. So it's a cool thing to be a part of. And I'll say the last thing that happened, so I get done with my skit, right? I'm pretty happy about that. It goes well, obviously. And, you know, my work is done for the night. I'm just watching the rest of the show from behind the scenes. And certain guy you might recognize was hanging out there, named Steven Spielberg. And he has his own little booth. Yeah, he might have heard of him. And he's got his own little section that they let him hang out in. He happened to be flying through New York. He's a fan of the show, so he's often there. And we were chatting, and it was just me and him. And he was like, "Dan, you got great comedic timing. And, you know, hell, if you wanted to have a future in Hollywood, you could." And I was like, that's the greatest compliment ever from like the perfect person,
right?
You know, to give that kind of compliment. Man. It's one thing if like you told me I was a good actor. I mean, I'd be like, well, thanks, but you don't know anything about acting.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. but Steven Spielberg told me that. So I was like, that's a pretty good compliment. But the problem was nobody heard it. And so, I saw my wife, Tara, like she was watching the show. She was like across the stage and I motioned for her to come over. I was like, hey, Tara, this is Steven Spielberg. And he just told me something really great. Mr. Spielberg, can you go ahead and repeat what you just told me? And he like looked at me awkwardly. Like, you want me to repeat it? Yeah, repeat the compliment because my wife's here to listen. So he does. And my Tara like looks at me like,
oh, I said it. He should have been that. Like, I don't know what you're talking about, buddy.
Yeah, he's like, I don't know what you're talking about. He's like, you could have done better. Like, dang it. Yeah, but I have a witness, and Tara wouldn't lie. Tara would not. You know Tara.
Yes, so I love her.
This did happen. I promise. And that was the Saturday Night Live deal, and then everything has been kind of crazy ever since. And you know, I guess getting back to your original question, Mel, which is what it's like over the last year. I mean, I got other to compare it to. Obviously, it's not that different than the SEAL teams in the sense that like people are still trying to literally kill me.
Yeah, right.
So every job I've had that's still a thing, which is funny. Keeps it interesting. But it's a really divisive Congress. I mean, as we record this right now, I don't know when you're posting it, but today was the day that Nancy Pelosi announced that impeachment, told her committees to draw up articles of impeachment. So, you know, that's sort of the culmination of how divisive this Congress has been. And that's unfortunate. There's certain things that we could get done. There's plenty that we do agree on. I would say that a lot of the bills that get put on the floor, you know, you could strip out like 20% of the things in those bills oftentimes and get Republicans to vote for it. So you could have an 80% solution that would maybe make it through the Senate and get to the president's desk. But that never happened. Instead, these are drawn up by what I think are, you know, far left think tanks. They're sold to more moderate Democrats and who said they wouldn't be voting for those kind of things, but they do anyway. And then they go nowhere. So you pass plenty of bills out of the House, but most of them won't go anywhere because there was never any agreement on or collaboration on those kind of solutions. And I think that's unfortunate. And this impeachment inquiry is sort of in the height of unfortunate partisanship and conflict that I think has characterized the House thus far. That being said, I'm not all negative about it. I enjoy having an impact, and there's other ways that we can make an impact besides legislation. So, you know, for instance, I've got a great team back in the district that does constituent services. I mean, we've done some really cool things for people that have really changed their lives because we have really dedicated staff back there that really makes us look great because, you know, people will call in about their VA benefits. They'll call in about a visa or, you know, I mean, people have been in really dire straits. One man had his daughter was kidnapped and brought to Ireland. We were able to work with the State Department and get her back. I mean, there's some really neat things that actually keep you going, and make it all worth it.
That's crazy. So is there like one thing that you've been super passionate about, but the Democrats are just not letting you move forward with it?
Yeah, I would say, you know, one of my big projects early on in the term was the border and, you know, messaging on why we need better border security. And unfortunately, that went nowhere, of course, but it's important to our constituents, that's for sure. It's important to Texans. And there has been improvements over that because the president has been able and DHS has gotten its act together and been able to implement some important reforms. But that really, if I were to simplify the reforms that they're doing, it's basically law enforcement. We were unable to enforce the law for a long time. So you have tens of thousands of people crossing the border, and that's actually not the problem, right? You can't control how many people are setting foot on from Mexico onto the United States. You'll never be able to control that. Like, only the Mexicans can control that. But what you can control is the enforcement that occurs once they set foot on our side. Okay. And that's where a huge failure has been this entire time, because we've been overwhelmed. We have these quirky laws that don't quite work well for our border patrol and our immigration officials. There's been some ways to tweak that to provide more resources towards that, so that law is enforced. And I can get into a lot of detail on what exactly those changes are, but just know that there's been a lot of improvements there, thank God. So, you know, in March, we were at 140,000 or so people crossing the border, and a lot of those weren't getting turned back. That's the big problem.
Yeah.
Now, that, you know, it's the catch and release program, and that's not good. You know, we've created an entire new generation of dreamers, right, that we have to deal with now. And it's not clear how that's going to work.
But the problem is that they're not all dreamers. Marcus and I got the opportunity.
Dude, we went down there.
Yeah, we got to go down there too. I know, right. You did as well. And we were allowed to go into the detention centers and see for ourselves. I mean, we're not politicians. We have no agenda other than we were there just checking it all out and supporting the Border Patrol. But what the most disturbing thing that I saw was the men, the single men with little kids, and they had just done a pilot program, a DNA pilot program, and it was showed that they were not related to these men. And the Border Patrol was telling us that they have this rent-a-kid program that the cartels are doing. That is human trafficking. That is not a dreamer. That's not immigration. That's human trafficking. We have to stop this. It made me so disgusted and angry and sad to see that. And I don't understand how anyone can be okay with that.
And they call it a detention center. It's not prison, not jail. It literally detention as if you were when you were in high school. It's a building. And we watched the whole process. And check it out. If you live in this country, I mean, if you're a citizen of this country and you're over, let's say 70 years old or 60 years old, and someone doesn't bring you a brand new toothbrush every morning. I mean, I'm not talking about replacing. I'm talking about bringing you a brand new toothbrush. Clean your sheets, wash all your clothes and TV. All your meals are provided for you. If you say that you're sick, two people literally escort you from when you were in detention because you came over
illegally.
Well, don't even call that. You didn't use the door. I mean, come in here, just use the door. Anybody who's wanting to come in here, they want to do it the right. If they're really refugees, they will use the door. They won't help. They won't take the chance of crawling all that way and then going through a river and dying, because the amount of trash and all of my environmental buddies, if y'all knew the trash that was going, that's been dumped into that river, it's amazing. And basically what happens is, imagine if you're standing in line to get your driver's license. And the minute you get to the counter, 1,000 people jump in front of you. And then you go through the line again, and you get up and you get to sign your name in, but 1,000 more jump in front of you. Not only that, there's a regiment. So if they come in here and they don't get their phone call within a time, they'll literally sue the detention center employees. And that, like, when all those people were screaming and yelling about how the Border Patrol agents were bad and vicious, that is absolute crap. These are the best people in the world, man. And they were bringing their own toys from their own kids and bringing them in there to facilitate these children, who you can look in there and see that these kids are just sitting there with a man who's not a dad, because a father of their child will protect them completely. These kids are running around everywhere playing and whatnot. And then while these guys literally get processed through there, and if you don't release them on time, they'll sue the people that are working there. And all the medical and dental people literally come over to get put in the detention center so they can go to their medical checkups to get their AIDS medicine or whatever it is. So if you're literally a retired American citizen and you're not getting every benefit that you could possibly think of, It has nothing whether or not we want them over here visiting our property or visiting the land or not, right? It's all of ours, right? It's the ones that come in here to not even stay, just to abuse that part of the system. And then they work their way back over. And all of those Border Patrol agents are trying so hard to prevent that because it's like 60 other countries that are pulling through here. And what they do, the cartels will send the kids up the middle because they know that we'll go take care of those children, and then they'll run the drugs up the side. But just think about it. Anybody right. Who comes to visit or wants to come over here for a good reason, they will use the door or the gate, right? They said that all out of all those tens of thousands of people that come over here, 2% of them actually have a claim that is viable.
And about 90% don't show up when they're to their courts. And Democrats will try to say that. Well, Democrats will come back with a counterpoint on this one, and you have to understand what the counterpoint is. So they'll say, actually, the statistics show that like 99% showed up. What they're referencing is a very specific program that costs a lot of money. It was a pilot program, and it only applied to a few thousand illegal immigrants. And yeah, 99% of them showed up because they had ankle bracelets on, and it cost about $40,000 per person. So it's not efficient. We're not doing it to get them to show up for their court dates. But then remember, there's different court dates too. So while a lot of them show up for their first court date, they're not showing up for their second and third and fourth. And they eventually get lost in the system. And this is kind of what I mean by a whole new generation of dreamers, right? Because you're in this, like you said, Mel, like they're trafficking kids through. And when that happens and we identify that, we can send back the adults. So single adults that come through the border, our system works okay, actually. Like they get deported. It's not, that isn't the problem. The problem is the loophole with the kids because of the Flores settlement. There's all these complicated reasons for that, right? There's a Flores settlement. There's rules that we have surrounding minors. So they know that the kids are their ticket in, which is why they traffic them, okay? And it's why they have that revolving door. Those kids still get lost in the system eventually, right? And they're undocumented. And again, you know, 10 years from now, there's going to be a bunch of people advocating for them because by the time they're teenagers or in their 20s, like they probably don't speak Spanish that well anymore. They speak English. They're probably integrated into society, but they're undocumented. And then we have millions of more of these people who. You know, what are we supposed to do with them, right? The same conversation that we're having now with dreamers, but it all comes back to this source problem, which is we have an open border and we have a catch and release program on top of that, and you guys mentioned a couple other things, which is how they use the system against us, and how the left helps them use the system against us. You know, where our goodwill is taken advantage of, and my big problem with that overall. Is it's completely unsustainable. Like it really is just as simple as that. Like that should be our argument, our best argument for why we need a secure border and to actually enforce the law, because anything less than that is just unsustainable. You know, I can tell you that I'm a good person and that I deserve to have, you know, a room in your house and your food, and I want to take it. I just want it. And I'm a good person. So why can't I have it? And I want to bring more of my friends and one more and one more and one more. Eventually, you can't. Eventually, it's totally unsustainable. And you scale that out into an entire country. You know, there are real costs to unmitigated migration. It's not a sustainable prospect, whether through our court system, through our school system, through our healthcare system, just the number of low-skilled jobs that we really have. I think there's good evidence that it drives wages down, especially for low-skilled workers. That doesn't really hurt people like you and me. It doesn't hurt people even in the upper middle class, but it does hurt people in the lower skill sectors of the economy. So, like, there's real cost to this and consequences. There's also cultural consequences. Like, you can't integrate that many people quickly. Like, we are an open arms kind of country. I do believe that anybody in the world can become an American.
Sure.
But you have to become an American, right? And there's a process to it. And And I want that process to be efficient and you know, somewhat not easy, but at least I want there to be light at the end of the tunnel. But what they'll say, too, is, well, you know, they can't go to a point of entry because there's a long line.
Well, yeah.
I mean, I don't disagree with that. There's a long line. I don't know of any other place in the world where there's not a line. I mean,
when something's worth having, and there'll be a line.
Yeah.
And just imagine anything you're standing in to get food or anything, and right when you get to the counter, 1,000 people jump in front of you. Well, of course you're going to do whatever you can to get in the system.
Right.
That's what's so great about this place. If you want to be a part of it, imagine the pride that comes with actually being an American. And if you're overseas somewhere and someone snatched you up or something, you know that because that you're an American and you're documented, we know that you are, and we'll come get you. We'll send whatever we have to do to come get you. And it's the only time you ever have to stand up and acknowledge the fact that you're an American is when we say the pledge. That's why we say it.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I mean, it means something. And you go to our citizenship ceremonies, and they're pretty neat. I mean, to watch a lot of these people who have worked hard to get their citizenship and how happy they are to wave an American flag. It's a pretty cool thing.
Oh, we've seen it too. Yeah, bro. I mean, it's amazing. It's a badge of honor.
All right. So we want to hear what you're most proud of since you've been in.
Well, what our proudest accomplishments are? Well, I mean, you know, I'll just go for our local listeners, the accomplishments that we're most proud of what we've been able to do with respect to working with the Army Corps of Engineers and FEMA and getting certain projects started or finished in my district with respect to flood mitigation. That's our biggest issue in Houston. It rains a lot, obviously, and our infrastructure is not up to par. It really hasn't been for, let's just say, forever. We've been flooding for a very long time, and this is the frustrating thing about this. I just got into government, and this isn't a new problem. You know, like some people like to point to climate change. This isn't a new problem. We've been flooding for a long time.
I remember specifically.
We have to do something about it.
Yeah, growing up in Houston, I remember being about 8 years old, maybe 9, and I don't remember which hurricane it was. I think Alice, but I don't know for sure. And our neighborhood flooded, totally flooded. The houses didn't flood, but the streets did. There was several feet of water. And the kids all went swimming in the streets. I had no idea that that was sewage water.
Boom. A little mealy dysentery for you.
As an adult, I would be so disgusted if my kids were doing that. But when we were little, that's what we did. And I'm alive and I didn't get any infection, but... we've been flooding for a very long time.
Right. And, you know, but related to the climate change debate, I will hit on this a little bit is, I think what you'll see from Republicans over the next few months is a much more coherent response to the radicalism of the Green New Deal. I mean, it's really easy to call the Green New Deal foolish and stupid because it is, it's all of those things. It's not based on science. It's not based on engineering. It's not based on good policy. It's not based on economics. It's not based on anything except radical thought and emotions. So we can say, I can make a good argument for that, but people still want to know, well, okay. I mean, but what's your solution? And we do need that. I mean, I think we do have an interest in addressing carbon emissions worldwide and just basically having cleaner air and better conservation and better water, right? I think everybody generally agrees on that. But there's smarter ways to do it, market-based ways. You know, for instance, I introduced legislation called the Leading Act. Senator Cornyn introduced the same legislation in the Senate. And what this does is it repurposes some Department of Energy grant money to be used for carbon capture technology pilot programs in the natural gas space. So, and this isn't pie in the sky thinking. There's a electrical plant just outside of Houston called Net Power. They take in natural gas. They use it to create electricity. They suck up the carbon from that process, and they recycle it through their systems and power their plant that way. So it's actually zero emissions.
Wow.
Net zero emissions. You know, there's another coal-fired power plant that also reduced its emissions by like some enormous amount by capturing the carbon, and then they sell it. People don't realize carbon dioxide is a commodity. It's not a pollutant. I mean, you breathe out carbon dioxide. So to classify it as a pollutant is silly. You need to look at it like a commodity, and there's a lot of people who want to buy it. Greenhouses, you know, use the levels of carbon dioxide in a greenhouse are like 14 times normal air, because that's what plants thrive in. That's why the world has gotten greener. Also, you know, we have higher carbon dioxide levels, but the world has also gotten greener as a result. You know, so climate change has multiple effects. But also, it's used for oil and gas extraction. It's used for growing algae. It's used for all sorts of things. There's some people who think that you might be able to make gasoline out of it soon. Like this is the science is developing towards that. I mean, you use it to make concrete. Feel like there's uses for it. So there's smart market-based ways to do this. You also have to understand the United States is one of the has decreased carbon emissions more than any other country. It's like not even close. But how have we done that? We've done it through natural gas. So when Elizabeth Warren wants to ban fracking, that would actually increase carbon emissions. If you just banned fracking today, that would increase carbon emissions because power plants would have to transition to coal. Yeah, I mean, you could spend a ton of money and try to transition to nuclear, and I'm in favor of providing a better path towards nuclear, by the way, also. I mean, but again, the Green New Deal advocates, they want to get rid of nuclear, which is crazy. It's a zero carbon emission. Oh, so that's how you know they're not serious.
They're not happy with anything.
No, it's radicalism run amok, and it's radicalism that's been normalized, and what it's done is it's made logical policy conversation really difficult because these people come at you with these crazy ideas, right, that have been debunked forever, whether it's hey, we're going to have only wind and solar and live in this kind of utopia green world. We're going to have socialism. It's going to be great. And you're like, well, those ideas have already been proven not to work. So can we talk about the stuff that might actually work maybe? And they're like, no, we can't talk about that.
Yeah,
we got to set our goalposts way over here.
If you want socialism, then you guys aren't even social enough to get along right now.
Well, it's funny because
that's true.
Those who,
you know what I mean? It's like you're yelling at us to get that done. How's it going to be if as long as we stay in line, no one will yell? Well, how many humans do you put together before somebody wants to act like a fool?
Yeah,
or doesn't.
Yeah.
I mean, it comes down to the people that complain about climate change the most are the people living in the cities, creating the most pollution. I mean, Marcus and I live out in the country. We're on lots of land. We care very much about the environment. Yeah. We plant trees. We're joking about kids.
That. Yeah, the liberal, the millennials and stuff like that, they love being outside, working with the animals. I mean, you're not a liberal. You're a farmer. You're just like us, man. Just they told you that we're in some way different, but we're not. All the animals, we take care of them, take care of the environment out here to make it a better place. But for some reason,
the hypocrisy is infuriating.
Yeah, well, it's just crazy because they just don't listen and they don't think simple-minded. They think extreme, radical, and not just like, okay, what can I do to make a difference and not worry about everybody else.
We all get the weather change thing, but we got to have the steps to get that. You can't just, if it took a long time for it to swing that way, it's going to have to be a long time to get it back around.
Yeah, and that's another point when you're in this debate is the cost benefit. Because I mean, what you're saying there is, you could. Let's say we implemented a Green New Deal and we got it implemented within 10 years. So let's set aside the economic effects of that, which would be extremely dire, by the way. I mean, extremely dire. But hey, we'd have zero emissions. So let's say the U.S. had zero emissions within the next 10 years. The U.S. emits 15% of carbon dioxide in the world. So that's what you're doing. You're getting rid of 15% of carbon dioxide. China and India are still doing their thing. Developing countries will continue to increase their emissions because they want to lift their people out of poverty. So they're going to use what energy needs they're going to use. 15% reduction by the IPCC, which is the UN's own numbers. You're talking by 2100, you're talking a decrease in temperature by like 0.15 degrees Celsius, which is really not that different from zero. So what's the point? You know, so you're like, what's the actual benefit?
I'd love to see actually how they got those numbers. Like, I want to see exactly how you got that number.
They use a bunch of computer modeling and You know, and that's the other problem with their computer modeling is you change a couple of parameters that are, you know, within reason, and you vastly change the outcomes. So that's why it's also, it's hard to take a lot of these predictions seriously. If any scientist is being honest with you, they would just say, well, we're not really sure what the effects of higher temperatures will be. You know, you might be this, you might see this. It's hard to specifically attribute one event to this kind of change. I mean, it's a very complicated mess. I mean, is there some kind of climate change going on? Yeah, sure. I mean, I think we can see that. But how the question is how we adapt to that and whether we should destroy an economy in order to adapt to that. Like that's the real question that we have to be answering. And that's why I look to technology-driven solutions, because if you're looking at technology-driven solutions like these carbon capture technologies I was just talking about, if you're looking at exporting natural gas to countries like China and India that are largely burning coal, well, you're actually doing something that will work. And you're focusing on 100% of the problem as opposed to just the United States, which is 15% of the problem. So you have to leverage the strength of the United States, and our strength is innovative capacity. And getting that innovation out there to the rest of the world is how we actually reduce emissions. And then we have to be realistic about what reducing emissions will look like. It won't change. We're not going to all have weather like San Diego all of a sudden, which kind of seems to be like the case that the left likes to sell you. You know?
Sorry,
like,
you moved from California to Texas.
There's
going to
be tornadoes and hurricanes
weather.
Constantly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you said it just perfect. Is that the scientists who use the numbers that are calculated by the computer? The computer, the one thing it can't do is reason. It doesn't have that humans have that component. If you take that computer model and try and strap it down on the human race, it doesn't. There's a missing piece.
No, and they twist the data around. You know, we had a hearing on this, which was really interesting, and we had it in the budget committee, of all places. But it was about the costs of climate change. And what they'll try to do is they'll attribute costs to heat-related death. Okay, so that's interesting. So what they're saying is that as it gets hotter, there's going to be more heat-related death, and then they attribute a cost to that. And that's the vast majority of costs, by the way. The vast majority is death. But once you dig into their numbers, and we had another witness on our side who was like who just totally debunked these nonsense numbers. They're like, by your analysis, you're saying that Philadelphia will get almost as hot as Houston, right? Not as hot as Houston is now, but almost as hot like 50 years from now, because it's Philadelphia. And it's just not as hot as Houston. We know that we're from Houston. And then what they're saying is that in 50 years, the heat-related deaths in Philadelphia will be like 30 or 40 times what they are in Houston now. Now, that doesn't make any sense at all, does it? Like, so not at all.
Yeah, and when you don't understand, they're like, well, you're just not smart enough to understand the numbers. I'm like, no, that's not what that means. It just means that didn't make sense.
I love your videos that you do on Instagram that just breaks it down to every day, every person can understand what the bills are and all that. I think that's super cool that you do that.
Yeah, you're a government teacher. Good. I mean,
it's really cool.
Yeah, squared away.
Because otherwise, we have no idea what's going on in Congress. We have no idea what y'all do. And I just think it's really neat that you bring that to your followers and let us see the behind the scenes on that. But the big thing is, what are y'all doing for Christmas?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe hang out with you guys.
Come on.
Come on.
we actually haven't figured out plans yet, to be honest. We do have to figure that out. I don't know. But yeah, the Latrell's place is quite nice.
Bring
it
on.
I like hanging out up there.
Well, Marcus is really into cooking now. He'll make you a prime rib, and you and Tara and the dogs come out and...
Good casserole.
Yeah.
Made by Marcus Luttrell.
He's really good.
Like I said, brother, this is the awesome part of life. If guys had this part figured out in the beginning, whew, man, we'd have a little less scars. I'd just wake up in the morning, you know, kids off, wife goes off to work around the house, clean the kitchen, do some vacuuming, cook some dinner.
The funniest thing is Marcus started cooking by watching YouTubers. And these YouTubers that cook are so different, and he'll sit there.
It's a diverse crowd. I call them my intel officers.
Yeah. I mean, It's really funny, but he sits there and argues with the YouTuber as he's cooking.
Oh, really?
Oh my gosh.
What do they respond back, Marcus?
Sometimes.
No, but it's so funny. One of them is he's gay and he's Jewish and he's always like bringing in sexual innuendos with his food, and he'll talk about his big sausages. And Marcus is like, "Shut up, Jeffrey. Just get to the next bar.
Keep it in the kitchen."
It's so funny. I love it. I think we should have a Marcus YouTube video or a YouTube channel of him watching the YouTubers cook.
Guy can cook. It's great. Oh, I mean,
that'd be amazing.
But yeah. it's his conversations that he's have, one-sided conversations he's having with these people. That's so funny. But the food is amazing. And you and Tara should come out for it.
Maybe we will. Try Marcus's famous cooking. I like that idea. Man, I don't get to cook at all anymore. There was a time in my life where I cooked a little bit more.
Well, yeah, I had the Foreman grill too, buddy.
Uber Eats now.
Yeah, I remember the Foreman grill.
Well, what can we plug for you? What do you have going on right now that you want to tell the listeners about?
Oh boy, I plugged a lot of it. I mean, you know, hey, I mean, you mentioned those Here's the Truth videos. They appreciate that. We love doing those. We'll keep them up. It's a great way to just inform people. I mean, you got to see. I think people in Congress often see their roles as either one or the other, right? They're either like they're always on the media, or they're just behind the scenes doing legislation, but they don't really tell anybody about the work they do, and you know, they get punished for it. You've got to have a healthy balance of both of those. You've got to be accomplishing things, but you also have to be telling people like what you're accomplishing. And that means, you know, getting out there and getting on social media and reaching out to the youth. I mean, you know, what's interesting is, do you like those videos on Instagram? If you were over 50, you'd probably tell me you like watching, you know, my Fox News hit. So you've got to do all of it in order to reach everybody, because the older generations, they want to watch TV, right? But young people like me, like I don't have cable. You know, I just have Netflix. Like that's when I'm at home, like that's what I'm watching.
I actually do watch Fox too. I see you on both.
Yeah. You got both. Yeah. But that's rare. So it's always interesting to hear from different voters and see like what they like to see. And you've got to reach everybody, and you know, you've got to have different formats to reach everybody. And like it's just important, especially with the youth, because the youth are generally leaning left. And I think if you talk to them deeply about a lot of policies, they might agree with us a lot more, but they don't even know what we think. So it's a challenge. But I like going to college campuses and high schools and talking to kids and spreading the message.
Well, brother, we'll keep doing that. You did one quick question. What's your IG handle?
Dan Crenshaw TX. And that's same on Twitter. And, you know, I've got two Twitter accounts, one official, one campaign. And follow me on both, because they're both great. There's two Facebook accounts.
Wonderful.
I have one.
Absolutely wonderful.
One Instagram account. Yeah, one Instagram account, Dan Crenshaw TX.
We love it. We love everything you do. And
Brother, great job, man. And we'll see you for Christmas. Hug the missus. Tell everybody up there we said howdy.
All right, we'll do. Hey, great to be on with you guys again.
Yeah.
See you soon.
Yep. Butter.
Talk soon.
All right, guys, it's time for another listener story. And this week, our listener story is titled Postpartum, and it is written in by Thomas. Thomas, thanks for sharing your story. I have been listening to the T&Q podcast for the last month or so and have thoroughly enjoyed the stories and motivation. I've struggled with wanting to write this story, not only because of the trauma it caused our family, but because I was not sure if it qualified for the Team Never Quit podcast. The more I listened, the more it pulled at my heart to share the story. At our 19-week ultrasound for our second son, we discovered that something was wrong with my son, and we were sent to a level 2 ultrasound. Now, if you've never been to a level 2 ultrasound, saying that it is intense is an understatement. They measured everything from brain cavity fluid to blood flow. This is how we discovered that my son would be born with clubfoot. Now, our son was born on August of 2016, and within 7 days was in dual cast from his toes up to just above his knees. This would be the start of a 10-week series of casting on a weekly basis to correct the clubfoot, and have been in what's called boots and bar since then, and will be every night until he is 5 years old. This was a high anxiety diagnosis for my wife and resulted in many doctor's appointments and chiropractor appointments for my son on his first few months of life. The midwife we used identified that my wife had the baby blues and began her on a medication for postpartum. Now, I was naive to the severity of this condition and the internal struggle that my wife was battling on a daily basis. It came to a head when my wife, crying in the psychologist's office, was recommended for an inpatient therapy targeted at postpartum moms at a nearby hospital. My wife went in voluntarily and spent 9 days in this specialized unit and got out on Christmas Eve. She was so dead set on getting out for the holidays that she had tricked the doctors and herself into thinking she had overcome those suicidal thoughts. A few days later, she was crying on the floor in the kitchen and we had to go back to the hospital via the emergency room. On this stint, she spent 21 days on the ward. She came out of the hospital and back home, but she wasn't really present. We referred to it as a fog. Over the next 3 years, we battled the ups and downs of managing life with mental health and the triggers that would set off the suicidal thoughts and feelings for days to weeks at a time. In August of 2019, we celebrated my son's third birthday. It's been a long road to this day and served as a moment to celebrate on multiple fronts. On this day, my wife was finally taken off all her medications for postpartum depression and suicidal thoughts, and now she's back. My wife is a never-quit story. For many months, she had planned on ways to commit suicide. As we passed Veterans Day, this sat heavy on my heart, knowing the Mission 22 focus and the number of veterans and civilians, for that matter, dealing with mental health issues, as well as those who are supporting those loved ones struggling. For those of you struggling, please seek help. Never quit. It is worth the fight, and there are people who love you and are here to support you.
Sometimes we get shackled at birth with kind of anomalies that you look at, and it's kind of considered a hindrance, but in reality, it's there for a reason, because of how strong you're going to become. So, third birthday, I hope you have many more. I remember Forrest Gump? That's the first thing that popped in my head. Your legs are messed up, then eventually you turn into a football player, a war hero. So don't let anything like that keep you back. And it sounds like you've got awesome parents, and they're pushing you in the direction that you need to go. And that postpartum stuff, I mean, women, hats off to y'all. Y'all go through so much more stuff than we have to just to make this work. Seriously, it's something. It's unbelievable. But thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, Thomas, thanks for sharing your story. You know, the fact that you and your wife, you know, were able to, you know, take this experience, and although it was a hard time, especially for those first 3 years, you know, and your wife went through a lot with postpartum, the fact that she came out stronger at the end and she'll continue to fight the good fight going forward, you know, it's amazing to have those opportunities to just see what you're made of. And so, you know, I hope all continues to go well for your family. Hope your son continues to improve every year. Hope he has many more birthdays, and hope your wife continues to fight the good fight and never quit.
It definitely lets you know what you're capable of. After you go through some trials like that, it just, when other things present themselves in front of you, if it can't do to you what the past has done, then don't worry about it. It's just white noise.
Hey, we love it when you share your stories. You can actually share your story over at teamneverquit.com/podcast. Click the share your story button up in the navigation. Your stories inspire others to never quit. And we love sharing these stories. We love reading the stories. It's why we do what we do. Man, it was really cool to have Dan back on the show. I didn't get the pleasure to be involved in the first interview, but I've listened to it and it's amazing. And he seems like a really amazing guy. And so it was cool to have him on the show today.
Oh, yeah. I'm proud of him, man. He did the way he went about it.
He's classy, man. Like whenever that whole SNL stuff went down. Just like the fact that he wasn't super offended.
Well, yeah, it's comedy. And that's the problem, I think, is comedy's only kind of going one direction these days. And with SNL, they're brilliant. I mean, I've loved that show since I was a kid. As the week goes through, on Saturdays, you tune into them so they can bring a little levity to what's going on in our big family. And when only one side's getting picked on, you know, the comedy's going one way. When you try to throw out another, they think they're getting picked on. It's just not the case. And we truly need you guys to do what you do, just like we need our Dan, you know, doing his job. And then he was prepped for that being in the teams. I mean, that was brilliant. I love that. That's how it should be. I mean, we all, at the very least, should be able to laugh with each other, not at each other. Because yeah. We all make mistakes. We all do dumb things trying to make this big thing work. So never forget that.
Something that I've learned in the last 9 years, 9.5 years being around Team Guys, is they have an awesome sense of humor. and they use it to communicate. They use it to get through things. So it was very fitting for him to be on SNL. And I love Dan. I love what he's doing for the local district that he represents, and just in Washington in general. I think his freshman year has been, because of his SNL, kind of just leaped him into the public eye. He's used it really well, though, and he's used his platform.
Use that eye real well.
you get what I'm saying.
I did a good SNL skit.
Oh my gosh.
Make sure you guys follow him on Instagram, especially like if you want to have like just a little of insight into what's going on with politics. It can be really like overwhelming, especially like for younger folks. Like it's hard to like digest all that's going on the news. And I think Melanie mentioned it in the interview, but like he does a really great job of making these digestible videos on Instagram that are really easy to understand and they're relatable. So you can follow him on Dan Crenshaw TX on Instagram.
Humor is the best medicine for life. That's why it exists, truly. And you're right. If you can't find the humor in every situation, I mean, and you kind of look, then that's how you know someone's just truly being mean. And my grandmother used to call it being ugly. But yeah, Dan, thanks again, brother. We'll see you for the holidays.
Yeah, if you guys like this show, make sure you share it with a friend. We drop new episodes every single Wednesday. We do it for you guys. Obviously, this episode is actually airing on a Thursday because yesterday was Christmas, but every Wednesday.
Merry Christmas, everybody.
Merry Christmas. Again, we can't thank y'all enough for listening and being part of the team. It's growing every day. The people that we're helping and recruiting in here, it's building something that's truly exceptional. Button, thank you so much for being a part of this and letting us do this. It's an amazing thing. T, Andrew, and to everybody who keeps listening, keeps coming back, man, we love you guys so much. We hope that y'all have a very Merry Christmas.
And I'm just a sub here, but I love when I do get to sub in.
You're not a sub.
Yeah.
I am. You're the wife. I'm subbing in for Morgan, and I do love this community. I'm very involved behind the scenes, and I look at everybody's comments, and it really means a lot when people say that this podcast helps them get through tough days, and just keep sharing that feedback with us. And we really appreciate it. And we hope that you become part of our Patreon community.
See you guys next week.
We're out.